Support for Soundwaves from the Underground is brought to you by 24tix.com, the most convenient way to buy tickets to your favorite local concerts. Save time, save money, rock out. 24tix.com, your ticket to the experience.
Interesting. Even with Nas headlining it, that's probably why. Everyone saw him for free this year. No ticket sales. Fuck. I wanted to see Lauryn Hill. Well, I probably was going to make it out there anyway. Forget all that. I'm Dan Nalen, and this is Soundwaves from the Underground, the official podcast of Slug Magazine in Salt Lake City, Utah. Slug, an acronym for Salt Lake Underground, is one of the oldest independent publications in the United States, distributing free monthly issues about music, art, action sports, and subculture. On this episode, we're talking all about the business side of music. We're going to discuss CD Baby, Utah Lawyers for the Arts, and talk to Casey Hansen from the band Gaza about the lessons of touring for a rock and roll band. In the spring of 2012, music website CD Baby launched their new sync licensing program. The system is set up so that if an entertainment source is looking for independent music to use for TV, film, ads, or whatever else they may be creating, they can use the website to browse legally authorized tracks. The system works with Rumblefish, a company that specializes in sync licensing, to distribute the music and help bands who have their tracks featured on CD Baby get paid every time their music is heard. Slug's junior editor, Alexander Ortega, spoke with CD Baby's director of marketing, Kevin Bruner, about the new licensing program.
What are the services that CD Baby provides for underground artists?
We're a distribution company, so we were started by, you know, back in the day, it was in 98, we started with the first company to help artists sell their CDs online, because artists, unless you had a major label deal, had no access to selling music on the internet. In 2004, we started doing digital distribution to iTunes and Amazon and all those companies. And so now we sell CDs on our site, we do digital distribution, we sell MP3s on our own site, and we've also been doing things like helping artists get paid for their music being played on YouTube and other sync licensing opportunities. And so that's kind of some new territory we're kind of diversifying into as the music business shifts.
You mentioned iTunes and Amazon, and what are some of the other outlets that CD Baby connects artists' music to?
Spotify is a popular one now. The Rhapsody, eMusic, iHeartRadio, you name it. If you've heard of it and it's kind of a, you know, it's a legitimate music service, we're getting artist music there. Some of the things that we're doing that, you know, here in the U.S. people may not realize is that, you know, there's services around the world that may be popular in certain countries. We're also getting them into those places as well. Like, I just got back from Brazil, where CD Baby's been expanding our presence there, and they have some big services that are just available to people in their country that everyone there uses. So we're trying to get artists everywhere that it matters, not just here in the U.S., but globally.
That's awesome. I didn't even think about the international aspect.
Yeah. And the interesting thing is about the international aspect is that typically think very U.S.-centric about how people like to listen to music, and then there's certain regions of the world where, and Brazil's one of them, where CDs are very much what they want and what the artists want to sell for various reasons.
Mm-hmm.
In Brazil, it's piracy. They don't think anyone's going to buy a digital file. They think they're just going to steal it.
Right.
In other countries, it's just basically their technology hasn't caught up. So CDs are the way people buy music. So we've been not only doing some of the things on the digital front, but still looking for opportunities for artists to sell CDs, and we've actually been seeing some payoff there recently as well.
Say, for instance, I want to sell my music on iTunes and Amazon. Are they treated as separate services, or how does that work as you parse through the different entities of getting music out there to other people?
Yeah, they're all different entities and have their own kind of characteristics. Most everyone's familiar with iTunes and how it works. Amazon has its own store, and Google Play, that's another one we get people into. They have their own store, and they all have, you know, some different things they do to try and attract customers that may make the user experience a little different, and what, you know, payout for the artist is. You know, some of them try to do special deals to get people to choose them over going to iTunes, which is still, you know, the 100-pound gorilla that people are trying to crack.
So, right.
So there's things like that, you know, and then there's some stores offer different quality of downloads. There's, you know, people that love getting a WAV file or a higher quality MP3, and some of the stores are offering that. Or, you know, there's just streaming services like Spotify. So they all are different, and they all have their different quirks and things that users like about them. And so when you're an artist selling through us, you can decide if you want to go everywhere, if you just want to go to certain stores. We give you all that flexibility, which, you know, some artists are very particular. Other artists just want their music to be anywhere possible.
As you mentioned, you guys also license music, and so can you tell me the elements of that process?
With us, we've got a partner company that we're working with to provide this service, and a lot of what the focus is with this program is to take advantage of all the emerging consumer-generated content, user-generated content, that things like YouTube, Vimeo, anything from presentations to websites. There's a lot of people out there using music, and one, they want to get it legally, but they don't necessarily know how. And so with what we're doing is making music available not only to film and TV and Hollywood, like sync licensing is, you know, is traditionally been, but also offering sync licensing to consumers who just want to put a song in their YouTube video and know they're doing it legally, or in their presentation or their corporate video that's only going to be shown at work, but, you know, where do you get music is licensed legally for that use. So we're providing a lot of those opportunities, which pay less, but there are millions of people generating this content, and so there's so much opportunity here for artists to add another revenue stream of their music.
Right, so essentially it's just beneficial with all parties, or involving all parties that partake in the service.
YouTube's been making a lot of upgrades in their service as far as, you know, their ID, content ID system that notifies the user of, hey, so-and-so owns this track, or, you know, the rights. I think it's going to be something that, you know, it's a pretty big learning curve for the average user, but I think in the long run, people are going to be trained that they need to have the rights to put music in their video, you know, and here's an easy way to do it. There's anything you can imagine as far as the style and sound that you want available right here. License it for, you know, a couple bucks in your video, and then you're all set. On top of that, with our partnership with YouTube, artists make money off of their music on YouTube through ad revenue share that's generated as people watch and click on ads in the video. So if you've got a song in a video that's getting tons of clicks on the ad, you'll be getting some of that ad revenue, which it's not going to be annual paycheck, but it just helps build, you know, more revenue streams of opportunities for the music.
But what's the appeal for an underground artist to license their music?
Probably about early 2000s, it started becoming a way for unsigned artists, independent artists, to actually reach a pretty broad audience. If, you know, if you're licensing for film and TV, some of our biggest breakout selling artists ever on CD Baby have happened because they've had a song in a film or a TV show. For a while, Grey's Anatomy would always have like this closing montage with a song, and most of the time they were using independent music. A good bit of those folks were on CD Baby, and we saw it like drastically affect their sales and kind of being a building block to build their career. And, you know, one of our that's kind of the story of our all-time best-selling artist. She has sold made more money off of music than she would have if she had been with a major label, just because stuck with CD Baby and has made seven figures a couple times over.
what degree do you promote lesser-known artists so that their work is attractive to filmmakers and TV, video game people, YouTube? Is that up to the artists, or how does that kind of work?
The partner company that we've got working with us, they're called Rumblefish. They do that pitching to film and TV. The interesting thing about sync licensing is you have to have a completely different mindset than, you know, a lot of people think about popularity on radio or sales, things that are generating a lot of sales. With sync licensing, it's really about the usage. So you could have the best album ever made sitting right there ready to go to be licensed, but that may not be what they're looking for. You know, a while back I was actually pitching tracks for film and TV for CD Baby before we had this new program.
Mm-hmm.
And I had some amazing bands in the sync catalog that I was never able to place, and it was frustrating because, you know, I kept getting requests for, we need something with a female vocal, or we need something with this or that, and it just really depends on what the production thinks will work in their scene or their commercial. Sometimes it's, we need something that says sunny day, literally. They're like, we need songs with that lyric in it. So it's a challenge to find the right music that fits what they're looking for. The cool thing is, since it's not based on popularity, that opens the door. That's why it's indie music became so big. Sync licensing, because it's, you know, if you go to just the major label well every time, you're going to pay a lot of money for it. And you've got a very limited scope of the kind of stuff that's being made, where when you go independent, you can find some of the craziest stuff, some of the, you know, stuff that sounds just as good as mainstream music, you know, mainstream label music, but it's cheaper, and it's a huge help for the independent artist, or, you know, just the options are endless. So that's why you, with sync licensing, you got to think differently about it. So it's all about what the production or the TV commercial or the ad or whatever's being made needs. So that, as far as, like, you know, we've, with our partnership through CD Baby, the company Rumblefish is pitching on those, on that basis. So it really, it's hard to say, it's like, you know, you can't really say, oh, this is going to get placed X amount of times and get used. It just depends on what's happening and what's needed.
How does your pricing work? I saw that it's a $49 price to have you guys put an album on various media outlets. Is that a one-time fee, or how does that work?
Yeah, it's a one-time fee. So if you want to have your album with CD Baby, you just sign it up at our site, and it's a $49 submission. We do take for digital distribution, a 9% cut on the back end. With sync licensing, it's a little bit of a different deal. It's affordable to get in and to get your music out there.
For more information on the sync licensing program, or to sign your music up to be sold and licensed, check out cdbaby.com for more details. Spelltalk, a three-piece garage band from Salt Lake City, first formed in 2007 as The Naked Eyes, releasing an album and an EP before changing their name in mid-2009. In 2011, the band released their most successful album, Touch It, which helped the band score gigs at CMJ and South by Southwest. Over the past year, the band has gone through a few lineup changes and attempted to go on as a trio, but they broke up in September 2012. Before breaking up, though, they released one last EP called Rough in late September. Here's a song called School Ain't Cool from the Spelltalk final EP, Rough. To download Ruff, as well as Spelltalk's entire catalog, visit them online at spelltalk.bandcamp.com. The Utah Lawyers for the Arts is a nonprofit organization that offers legal counseling for people involved with creative jobs. The organization was first formed in 1983 and is comprised of attorneys licensed in the state of Utah who donate their time to people who need advice on matters like copyright protection, contract negotiations, royalties, and other matters specifically pertaining to the arts. Earlier this year, Heather Snedden took over the role of executive director of the ULFA with the goal of expanding the organization with more attorneys looking to help young artists. Slug writer Nathan Housley sat down with Snedden to talk about the organization and her role.
Can you tell me how Utah Lawyers for the Arts got started?
We started in about 1983. Utah Lawyers for the Arts was formed as a nonprofit organization, and since then I think has had periods of time where it's quite active and other times when it's been fairly dormant. But the idea is that we provide some legal services to low-income artists that, you know, are struggling in some area that hopefully we can provide some support. I've just been president for a year and we're still trying to kind of build it back up. So that's what we're, you know, hoping to accomplish in the future.
How did you get involved?
You know, I actually saw Utah Lawyers for the Arts listed on another lawyer's resume along the way, probably a couple of years ago. I remember having a case against, I think this lawyer was against me on this particular case I was working on. And I was looking up her bio and I found out that she was involved with Utah Lawyers for the Arts. I'd never heard of it before and I thought it was interesting. So I started doing a little bit of kind of poking my head around to figure out what it was and ended up meeting the prior president named Susan Vogel. She was interested in getting some people involved in the organization. She had some other things on her plate that she was interested in pursuing. And so pretty soon found myself in the role of president, which I wasn't expecting. And so I'm still trying to figure out how you run a nonprofit as I run this nonprofit. But that's kind of how I initially stumbled upon it.
It sounds like it's been kind of dormant lately and you're trying to build it back up.
Yeah, and that may just be my own perception because I wasn't very familiar at all with the organization before I got involved. So my perception is that there wasn't a lot going on with it. I think it still is an organization that not very many people are aware of. So we're trying to build up not only our name in the community so that artists are a little more familiar with us being around and as a resource for them. We're essentially a referral organization that tries to link up artists with lawyers in town who are willing to take on pro bono work or free work for artists. We're not always successful in doing that very quickly because it's hard to find lawyers who can carve out time to take on free cases, but we try to do that as best we can. But I don't think we were doing a whole lot for a while and really weren't out there very much. So if we can kind of let people know what we're doing, that would be great. We also, as a secondary aspect of our organization, we like to put on different types of events, usually educational type events, kind of workshops for artists that are really directed towards issues that we think they're interested in learning more about. We just had a series of workshops, really more a lecture series, I think, at the Utah Museum of Contemporary Art this last spring. And a lot of those were focused on copyright issues and ownership issues of different types of works and the types of things you'll find yourself in the middle of if you're a musician or a writer or another type of artist and kind of issues that come up with that sort of thing that we had some really spectacular lawyers address the audience on. So we like to do those sorts of things. We're hoping to do more of that. And a big push that we need right now is for more lawyers to become involved with our organization and try to help us out and therefore build up our art community.
What kind of lawyers get involved in Utah Lawyers for the Arts? What is their motivation or how much time do they give to these pro bono causes or that sort of thing?
You know, it probably varies quite a bit. I think we have sort of an influx group of lawyers who've at some point along the way agreed to be part of our organization, and by part of that I mean have agreed to volunteer their time for cases that come their way that they have at that point in time to provide help with and that also they have the expertise in the particular area that an artist needs. I would say we have lawyers that have kind of expertise across the spectrum. I myself am a litigator. I do commercial litigation and there are not a lot of times where I have the expertise to provide a lot of help to artists who need, you know, a little bit more information about just ownership rights and different intellectual property issues and copyrights and those types of things that are not really my area so much. But we have a lot of artists who are interested in creating nonprofit organizations, setting those up, and different tax and accounting issues. So a lot of more transactional, organizational type things. And so we have some lawyers with some expertise in those areas. We haven't had many of these come along, but I suspect that, you know, some artists may find themselves in some litigation over ownership of their work. Those are a little bit more difficult for us to place just because of the nature of litigation and how time consuming sometimes it can be for us to find a lawyer with the right set of skills for a particular artist. So those are the challenges that we face sometimes. But I think we have a lot of lawyers who are very interested in the arts. They're either artists themselves or composers or have some other kind of affiliation with the art world that they have kind of a love for it and a passion for it, and they're really interested in, I think, giving back to a community that means a lot to them, and this is kind of our way of trying to be a part of that and do something that hopefully will be helpful.
Are there any legal pitfalls that you think artists or musicians should be aware of that may not come to mind when they think of, you know, I'm going to go out and create, but they don't necessarily think of legal implications for whatever it is that they're trying to do?
Yeah, I would say that there are a fair number of pitfalls in just that area of ownership of your work, of your songs, if you're a composer or in a band. You know, the types of issues that come up with, for example, in a band, you know, what your relationship is with the other band members and, you know, what you're going to come up with as your band name and what happens if you get that record deal and what if somebody wants to bow out of the band and you need a new person to come in, who's going to be entitled to the money that comes in. So those types of things, I think, are oftentimes overlooked and not thought of as a big deal, but down the road they might turn into one depending on what happens. So sometimes that's what we try to provide is a little bit of insight about the possibilities of what might happen in the future and ways that you want to protect yourself, whether it's in writing contracts to kind of really define, you know, if you're in a band, what your relationship is, if you're going to create a legal entity that defines you and kind of defines your rights with respect to each other, it might be a good idea. If you have, a particular kind of work that you're creating and you're, you know, trying to show that work somewhere or you're trying to sell it, you know, are there some rights there that maybe you're not aware of that you want to be protecting to make sure that, you know, you really either retain ownership in your work or you're really getting the most out of it that you can. And I think it's stuff that not a lot of people are familiar with, and even I'm not familiar with all of the ins and outs of it, but we certainly have some lawyers, even who are on our board, who do know that sort of thing, and I think it's really important to try to think ahead of what might happen and to try to plan for that. I mean, that's a big element, I think, of what we can provide is help artists think about what might come down in the future and try to plan for that by protecting your rights.
In the age of file sharing and, you know, using the internet as a marketing tool, you know, a lot of bands will distribute, you know, will stream their music or offer MP3s for free download. Do you have advice for artists or musicians who want to, you know, get their work out there? They want to use that to market themselves, but may not necessarily be thinking of the pitfalls of ownership, like you talked about. Or do you want to weigh in on that?
It's a little bit of a tricky area for me, just because it's out of my expertise. But I will say, having literally sat through some of the workshops that we offer in the spring, I've gotten a little bit of insight about it, but I certainly wouldn't bet the farm on it. But I think that's really the question is, you know, you want to get your music out there, you want to get people to know who you are and get familiar with your work and therefore be more interested in, you know, what you might have to offer in the future. And then there might be a question as to, well, if you start putting it in the public sphere without any protections, are you somehow losing your rights to your work, or do those rights remain? And I think, you know, my suggestion for musicians who are in that position is to, you know, I would always say, just because I am a lawyer, go talk to a lawyer so you understand what your rights are and whether what you're doing is really, you know, going to be the best for you. But, you know, certainly people aren't always in that position. But I would certainly say musicians have those types of questions or are about to kind of embark on that sort of thing, to really just think about that. And, you know, we have on our website a way in which artists can apply for assistance through our organization. I'm hoping we can get a little bit quicker at being able to respond to those and line people up with lawyers who can really answer those types of questions well. And so hopefully we'll improve on that this coming year. But they can apply if they qualify for free services. We can line them up with the types of lawyers, copyright lawyers, particularly one board member I have in mind who is a composer and knows quite a bit about this area of the law, can provide some really sound advice on that stuff.
To find out more about the Utah Lawyers for the Arts, get legal advice, to take some of their classes, or to seek them for help, visit them online at utahlawyersforthearts.org. And this is our weekly daily calendar, available every day at slugmag.com. And just a little reminder, if you want to get your listings in there, they are free. Just tap into slugmag.com. Or you can also pay a little extra and get some added content, a mere $50 a year or $5 a month to do that. We got a lot of great stuff happening coming up. On Tuesday, November 13th, L1011 is headlining at the Urban Lounge. They're a Los Angeles post-rock duo, known for combining their guitar and bass, doing some just crazy looping and a lot of extended jams with effects pedals and whatnot. They're really one of the best live things you can see out there. They've released 5 full-length albums, earning generally positive reviews out there. And I've seen them, and I can certainly vouch for an experience unlike many you've seen. I know there's a lot of two-piece rock and roll out there, but these guys are like a two-piece Rush, if you will. Prog rocky, arty, very strange. Their 5th album is called Transitions. It was just released earlier this month in October. On Wednesday, November 14th, one of the pioneers of reggae music, Toots and the Maytals, are headlining at the State Room on a special acoustic tour. They have Anders Osborne opening the show. People who don't know Toots and the Maytals are truly missing out. This guy was kicking around before Bob Marley and the Wailers took off. He went to jail and was released and started having hits in Jamaica in the mid to late 60s. He got onto Island Records just like Bob Marley eventually and had some serious mainstream hits. Songs like Pressure Drop were later covered by The Clash. 5446, That's My Number, was named after Toots' prison number. Really great stuff. If you've never seen them, a real treat. They're featured in The Harder They Come, the 1972 classic reggae film starring Jimmy Cliff. And Anders Osborne, the opening act, he is quite a mean story himself, an amazing guitar player, a favorite down at New Orleans Jazz Fest, so that should be a treat. Also on Wednesday, November 14th, Craft Lake City welcomes artist Michelle Christensen for their artist workshop series. She's going to teach people how to do a little ceramic mug painting at the West Elm store in City Creek. You'll bring your own design in, you'll be painting on a white ceramic mug, you'll get to meet other artsy people, it'll be a great event. It's held at the West Elm Salt Lake location. Again, pre-registration is required. Go to craftlakecity.com/workshops to sign up. A minimal charge will get you in to enjoy the fun. On Thursday, November 15th, if you're feeling a little flush and have a little money burning a hole in your pocket, Finca, a great new restaurant, is teaming up with Epic Beers for a Utah Craft Brewers dinner. You'll be able to enjoy Epic as well as Moab Brewery, Red Rock Brewery, Squatters, and Uinta Beers with a special menu. I would definitely recommend it if you've got a few bucks. It's $55 total for beer and for food. You go through several courses. It's a serious throwdown, so it's a big night out. I would highly recommend it. Go to FincaSLC.com for more details on that. Also on Thursday, November 15th, Joshua James has a new album about to come out. He's headlining a show down at Velour in Provo to help get things started for the new record. He opened for My Morning Jacket at the Twilight Concert Series this summer. He's a local favorite, although he also has roots in Nebraska, which of course makes him near and dear to my heart. North Platte Records, the North Platte River's in Nebraska. That's a little geography for everybody. Great show, worth going to Provo for if you've never been, and there's a lot of great food down there, so make a night of it in Provo. On Friday, November 16th, The English Beat, one of my personal favorites, are headlining at the Depot. These are one of those oldies 80s acts that are always super popular in Utah. The difference being, these guys don't suck.
Dave Wakeling still sounds great, an amazing voice, hasn't changed a bit from the early 80s, plays that amazing teardrop guitar still. He has a band of aces. They're not the original guys. It doesn't matter. They have a great song after great song. It's a dance party. You'll sweat. There'll be a lot of beautiful people there having a great time. Well worth checking out, and it's rarely over 15 or 20 bucks to see him. So that's on Friday, November 16th at the Depot. Over across town, you can stay a little more localized with Theta Knot, instrumental rock favorites from Salt Lake. They're playing at Bar Deluxe also on Friday, November 16th. And of course, before you go to any shows on Friday, it's Gallery Stroll all over downtown Salt Lake City. So an ideal opportunity to get out there, check out what some local contemporary artists are doing, maybe even get your Christmas shopping started, buying some local art. You can't think of a better thing than that to buy for a loved one or, you know, just a friend, whatever. Saturday, November 17th is one of the more ridiculous music-filled nights this town has seen in a little while, and I'm going to rattle through a few shows here, all of which I would gladly go to, and I still haven't decided what I'm going to do for myself. First up, Japan Droids, Canadian rock duo from Vancouver, put out one of my favorite records of the year, Celebration Rock, earlier this year. They were a band on the brink of breaking up. They're only two guys, so, you know, band, two guys. If they don't get along, it's all over. They stuck it out, got a lot of good buzz on this Celebration Rock record. For people who are big fans of just straight up, fun, good rock and roll, check out Japan Droids. They're headlining at the Urban Lounge. Another great show on Saturday, November 17th is again at the Depot, The Devil Makes Three. They're an American trio. They play kind of a punky bluegrass thing. Female stand-up bass player, great guitar singer. They're taking a serious step up. They've been through town a couple times playing at the Stateroom, a 300-seater. They're stepping up to a 1,200-seat place. They've been blowing up all over the country. A really great live band. I drank a lot of whiskey to these guys last time they were here, so much so that I don't remember it enough. I need to go see them again. It has a high possibility of happening on Saturday, November 17th. That is your weekly daily calendar. Be sure to check at slugmag.com every day for new events going up and put your own events on there as well. Download the app on your iPhone and check it again. Our next little musical interlude comes from Gaza, grindcore band from Salt Lake City that first formed in 2004 and released their debut EP, East, shortly thereafter. Since then, the group has gone on a couple of U.S. tours, and Casey Hansen from the band will be joining us in just a minute to talk about the touring life and the business of being a band on the road. Before that, though, we're going to play a little song called Tombless off of their third album called He Is Never Coming Back. We'll be right back. are here with Casey Hansen of Gaza, and he is going to give us a little of the ins and outs of touring as a member of various bands through the years. Why don't we start, Casey, with tell me a little bit about the very first time you went on the road, you know, who were you playing with and what was that experience like? And did your romantic ideas of being a touring musician match the reality when you got out there?
Well, I'm going to try to remember the sequence of questions right there. The first time I went on tour was May 2005. It was with Gaza, and I've really only done touring with Gaza, but it was by ourselves. It was 5 days. The planning was a bit of a disaster. I mean, in retrospect, and that's how it works with anything. Your first day on the job, your first anything is never the best.
You fumble through, right?
Sure. But yeah, we just did Salt Lake, Boise. We did 2 Portland days for some reason, and then a city called Wenatchee, Washington, which is in the middle of Washington, which if nobody's been there, it's not like the coast.
It's rural.
It's very farmy. Rural. It's yellow grass. It's... Yeah, and we played in the middle of the day at 2 o'clock at a park. It was wild because, I don't know, we sold a couple $100 worth of merch at that show, and it was mind-blowing. And
that's great.
We came home with having not lost any money, which is a small miracle. So
that's a victory, a major victory.
Yeah. There are some other little layers. Like, the first day of the tour was a show with the Black Dahlia Murder and Behemoth. Black Dahlia Murder seemed to like us. We did some trades, and we saw them again in Portland, actually, by complete coincidence. And they were wearing one of our shirts. We had a Utah Jazz parody shirt. It says Utah Gaza, and we thought it was a jazz shirt. Pulled over, talked to them, invited them to a show at this dive. Didn't think they were gonna come. And Trevor from Black Dahlia Murder actually showed up. Had some kids drive him from the show he played that night to come see us, where we played to 3 people and him. And he was really awesome and supportive, and that was kind of our beginnings, both on our first tour, but also kind of our inroad to...
Expanding beyond?
Well, kind of into the quote-unquote industry.
Okay.
He did a lot of work for us, bless his heart. I mean, it's awesome of him, but I mean, he was our ambassador of goodwill for a long time, and it really helped, but yeah, that was the first tour.
Do you remember, can you put yourself back there? What was the inspiration just to decide to go on the road? Was it a matter of other bands that you had played with here, you wanted to go out and play with them? Did you guys just say, we need to get out of town and play some shows to other people besides?
Well, I mean, you mentioned romantic notion, and I didn't really address that, so this is a perfect segue, because that was always it for me. I didn't know what else I wanted to do, and nothing sounded more appealing to me than traveling and playing music, and... if you're lucky, not have to pay out of pocket to do it.
Right.
So the second it came up, there was never a question for me. It was mostly the romantic thing. But on top of that, people start taking you more seriously when you start taking yourself more seriously.
Okay.
Touring, besides all the fun, whatever, the sentimental things, it's a lot of sacrifices. I hope that people understand that, but ultimately when you start playing out of town, people start taking you more seriously. And for me, Gaza was, besides it was really fun and I enjoyed it, it was something I took very seriously from the beginning. So it just was a natural part of the progression.
It was part of what you guys wanted to do from the get-go.
And John, actually, who's done several bands leading up to Gaza and since, he's the vocalist.
Yeah.
One of the reasons Gaza even started kind of is because he felt like he was kind of in a dead end with some of the things he was doing. People were going to school, starting families, buying houses, and it was kind of, you know, his dream to get out and do stuff too. So he, you know, rolled the dice on another project, and it ended up kind of working out. So
let's talk a little about those kind of nuts and bolts things, because you touch on something that lots of bands have to deal with, and especially in Utah, I would even guess, because people do get, you know, married younger here. They do lots of things younger here than other places.
Yeah.
So real life imposes itself on bands. So how hard is it to kind of get everyone in line where you're all in a place where you can leave town? And do you guys have to have, like, you know, you talk about having to, like, pay to do it sometimes. Do you guys have to have a little stash of money before you can even leave town and make sure that, you know, the van is fired up and good to go? Or how does that stuff work?
I wish I could say we were beyond that. I mean, things have improved, but not as much as someone might think. I don't know. I guess it would depend on the person you're talking to.
Sure.
But I've always come to the table expecting nothing, just wanting to get out and do my best under whatever circumstances there are.
Right.
Understanding that my level of control isn't as high as I would like it to be.
Okay.
You have to be prepared. I you know, I am a Boy Scout, so I've always planned that things wouldn't go so well, but tours tend to exceed my expectations. But I think we all kind of think like that. In terms of what it takes to get everyone on the same page, you know, schedules and the equal sacrifice from everyone, that's as much a part of the magic of being lucky enough to being in a touring band in the first place. There's so many elements of chemistry and of dumb luck that play into it that are beyond talent or hard work or whatever.
Or planning.
Well, yeah. I mean, there are people that have, you know, all the skill, all the work ethic, all the whatever in the world, and they just can't find a few other guys that are as into going all in as them, and, you know, then they get stuck at home or in projects that don't go as far as they'd like.
Things just fall apart, right?
Yeah, so I feel really lucky just because, again, just finding people in and of itself, even if they were hacks and they had no equipment and whatever, just finding people that are really, like, when it comes down to it, are willing to put the chips down and say, let's go, is hard enough. So to have all the factors come together, even eat with money you make, is a small miracle. So,
how does it work in terms of, without getting ridiculously specific about money and things, do you guys have like one person in the band is sort of the banker? Do you share those responsibilities? Do you guys have the same plan each time you go out? Or how does that work?
I wish we had this more down to an exact science, but we're slowly getting there. What I'm finding is that it's best to have input from everyone for everything.
Okay.
But that generally there is an unspoken understanding that one person is the, shall we say, executive over a certain facet. So,
okay.
Mike, for example, he's a engineering genius. He's been working on cars and various things since, I don't know, he was 5 or something. And he's saved our necks so many times with our van.
Yeah.
So he works on that. He drives a lot. He keeps everything going at a real base level. Booking gets difficult, or when we can't use an agent or whatever, I do a lot of the booking. I do a lot of the internet stuff. John and some interview stuff such as this.
Okay.
John and I kind of split duties on some of that stuff. Anthony, I don't know what happened one day. He would do these cool little art things for years that, you know, were just things he did for fun. And then one day he shows up and he has these really elaborate hand-drawn, hand-stipple, like, pieces that he's been pouring hours into. And they're incredible. And then we suddenly had someone that could make merch. And now he's kind of blowing up. He's doing work for other people now. So when a new thing comes up, it's kind of a, I don't know how to put this, I don't want to say free market, but when something new comes up, it just kind of falls in someone's lap.
Right. Everyone talks, and then it naturally evolves into somebody's role.
Sure. And I think that's good, because sometimes you just need someone to make a decision about something without...
Right.
But it's also important that all of us have a say
in
all of
it. You have to have buy-in to some degree from everybody. You're all going to have to pursue this thing.
I like to think we have a system of checks and balances and, I don't know, some sort of thing that resembles democracy.
Right, sure.
But you do need separation of powers and stuff.
Okay.
This is turning into a weird discussion right now.
Well, now let's... Looking outward from the band, you guys are on the road, you're an entity, you guys are all doing your things.
Mm-hmm.
Have you found dealing with people in the so-called industry, or even just at a club in a faraway town that you don't know, I mean, has your experience been relatively positive overall, negative? I mean, do you find, obviously there's going to be a lot of support because of independent music supports each other, but there are shady characters in all realms of business,
You're just saying generally going out?
Generally,
okay. I've been very pleasantly surprised. Again, having low expectations has done right by me for most of my life, and when my expectations start to grow, that's when I meet disappointment. But the point is, I don't know, I've been amazed, quite frankly. I've mentioned this at other times, but totally honestly, when we started, our objective was to purposefully write not just abrasive music, but like really just uncomfortable.
Challenging.
Yeah, challenging. I mean, not stuff that you can thrash and party to. Like,
right.
Like purposefully annoying and just stuff that isn't conducive to listenership from the casual listener. So when we started, I was, you know, I'd played in punk bands and I had learned to really appreciate clearing a room.
Yeah.
Like everyone leaving, I'd learned to really embrace that. Like, great. And so when we started, that was what I was excited for. I was like, great, we're gonna play these shows, it's gonna be a packed house, and everyone's gonna go away. But it didn't turn out that way, and every day it isn't that. There's a part of me that's a little bit surprised, but it's been good. And a lot of cities, and this isn't detracting from Salt Lake, have been more, I don't want to say more supportive, but we've had better turnouts, we've had more interaction, like Denver and Boise and... Indianapolis, New York City's been really great. Seattle, I don't know. There are certain spots that we just have the time
touch
of our
a
lives.
Nerve in there.
Yeah, and it's great. But I mean, there's certainly they're not all gems. You try to learn a lesson on how to read people, and how to generally avoid those. But we've been tremendously fortunate. I hear some of the horror stories from bands we've toured with or played with or whatever, and we've been lucky. I don't know how else to put it. Hopefully we're projecting something that brings
people are connecting.
I don't know. But we've mostly been pretty lucky. But
okay, we got time for one more question here for you, and this will be a very, you know, not that easy, I guess, but you know, a young musician or a young band comes up to you looking for some advice on what do they need to do to take that first step to get out on the road. I mean, do you have a suggestion? Is it a matter of hooking up with other bands that have done it before and going with them? Is it a matter of just making some calls to clubs? What do you think is the first most vital thing for a young band to do?
I think something that's seriously overlooked by everyone, including bands, the music that you play matters. Don't write it and don't play it and don't be in a band to be in a band.
Right.
Do it because you love music and write every song like it might be the last song you ever write. I can't speak enough to that, and I feel like that regardless of whatever subjective quality other people want to label it, if you mean it, that translates. And people notice that.
And you can find a place to play.
Yes.
And people to listen.
Honestly, if you're willing to work, you can figure out a way, in my opinion. But again, I've been really lucky. The other thing is, too, you just gotta have some brass balls about some things. Like, there is never a perfect situation where you can just say, okay, this is it.
Yeah.
All right, now I'm finally ready to do this.
Right, it's risk and sacrifice.
It's always a risk. Right. It's always a risk. No matter how sweet the deal is, you ink or whatever, there are no guarantees. And there are tomes of bands that thought that they had something because they signed a deal and they got to tour with a cool band or something, and they let it slip.
Yeah. Didn't even make it home alive.
if you don't have the gumption to make it happen, there's nothing in the world that can save you. Also, try to be friends with people in your band, because you're gonna spend a lot of time with them. Like, tour isn't.
It's an hour on stage and.
It's an hour
23
on stage.
Hours 23 doing stuff, right?
In a van or in some kid's basement or.
Yeah.
You better get along with them, because anything that isn't driving will come out.
Excellent.
Just be on point.
That's perfect. Great advice. Casey Hansen of Gaza, thank you so much. Really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Good luck. Thanks for listening to Soundways from the Underground. For all things Slug Magazine, be sure to visit slugmag.com. The holidays are quickly approaching, and we'll be talking about specialty brews for the winter months. What are the seasonal brews are you looking forward to the most? You can send an email to soundwaves@slugmag.com. Or call and leave us a message on our automated voicemail line at 858 233 9324. That line is open 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, and we just might play your suggested seasonal brew on the show. This podcast was created by Slug Magazine and produced by Gavin Sheehan. Associate producers are Esther Moronio, Ricky Vigil, Alexander Ortega, and myself, Dan Nalen. Executive producer is Angela H. Brown. The theme music performed by Birthquake and recorded by Jesse Ellis. The main logo and art design is by T. Doan and technical design by Kate Colgan. Next week, join us when we'll be talking to Martha Hayden, who had a new dinosaur named after her. We're going to talk about winter beers with the folks from Hopper's Brewery, and designer Bad Wolf Style will be making an appearance talking about their clothes.